WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. It's 7 a.m. in New York, and coming up next, What's Going On with Bob Henley.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is Work Bites Bob Henley at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. This is WBAI's Morning Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On. Michael G. Haskins is our audio engineer, and Linda Perry is our executive producer. It's just after 7 a.m., March 27th, 2023. This is your Monday morning drive time labor and social justice report. Sunrise was at 6:48 a.m. Sunset is at 7:15 p.m. It's 46 degrees under cloudy skies in New York City. We're headed up to the mid-50s with a 90% chance of rain later today. Tomorrow it cools off a bit and the clouds hang around. Wednesday the sun comes back and we settle into the low 50s. Thursday the sun brightens, but we may not break out of the low 40s. Friday, the temperature is warm into the 50s under a mix of sun and clouds. Looking ahead to the weekend, and who doesn't, we could break into the 70s with a 70% chance of rain with some strong winds on Saturday. Sunday, we're back down in that mid-50s, 40s range under mostly sunny skies. Over the weekend, the New York Times announced it was suspending 3 years of daily reporting on the status of COVID cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. The Times explained that the change was spurred by the declining availability of virus data from state and local health officials. The Times will now rely on the CDC's weekly county-level data analysis of virus conditions. This shift comes on as the average daily deaths dropped to 213 deaths a day. May 11th, President Biden is scheduled to formally announce the end of the pandemic emergency. This morning, I'm excited to be joined by Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude, which is heard on Pacifica stations around the country and originates on WNHN-FM in Concord, New Hampshire. For decades, Arnie has been a progressive trailblazer in one of the nation's most conservative states. She served in the New Hampshire House of Representatives, and in 1992, she became the first woman candidate nominated by a major party to run for governor in that state. Trained as a lawyer, she was a fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics, and for multiple presidential cycles, she has been sought after by the media to decode Granite State politics for the nation. We'll talk about her very provocative essay in The Nation about whether or not President Biden should run for re-election. In the second half of the show, we'll reflect on the 21st century legacy of the Triangle Fire that on March 25th, 1911, took the lives of 146 mostly immigrant women in a Lower Manhattan garment factory blaze that helped to galvanize the modern labor movement. This year at the commemoration, I'm glad to say the crowd was larger and trended younger than in past years, thanks to the presence of members of NYU's Contract Faculty United, UAW, who are looking for recognition from NYU, which now owns the building that housed the Triangle Factory. We'll be joined by Hannah Gurman, a clinical associate professor at NYU, about the status of the Contract Faculty's union campaign. And of course, your calls at 212-209-2877. But first, we go to Washington for the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times. No matter who you are or where you come from, you deserve a fair shake at a good life in this country and in this state, and that's exactly what we are going to deliver.
Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer celebrates with members of the Teamsters after repealing the state's right-to-work law, the first state to do so in more than 50 years. The law prohibited unions from collecting dues from non-union employees, even though they benefited from union protections. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves praised those helping residents recover from a series of tornadoes over the weekend, which killed at least 26 people and leveled entire neighborhoods.
Mississippians have done what Mississippians do. In times of tragedy, in times of crisis, they stand up and they show up.
President Joe Biden issued an emergency declaration Sunday, making federal funding available to affected areas. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fired his defense minister after he called for pausing a court system overhaul. Proposed judicial changes have sparked mass protests by members of the military and others who fear it could cripple democracy. Netanyahu's government holds a very slim majority. His critics say he wants to undermine the courts to cling to power and stay out of prison. Unfounded vote fraud claims are fueling strict new voter ID laws across the country. Former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams says eligible voters are being disenfranchised.
The United States has always required for you to prove who you are. But what has happened in the last decade has been that the standards, the bar has gotten higher and higher.
Ohio is now the ninth GOP-led state to enact new voter ID restrictions and no longer accepts military IDs. A new Idaho law prohibits students from using college IDs, and the state Supreme Court in North Carolina looks poised to revive a photo ID requirement declared unconstitutional just a few months ago. Progressive Representative Cori Bush of Missouri says President Biden is not following through on campaign promises to end federal executions.
Congress must act. Congress must pass legislation to abolish the federal death penalty and encourage states to follow suit.
Lawyers for some of the more than 40 federal death row inmates tell the Associated Press they've seen little change since former President Donald Trump left office. Dozens of legal filings show the Biden administration still actively fighting for the death penalty. According to the Labor Department, more than 800 companies employed nearly 4,000 children illegally in the last year. Critics say that's clashing with the education goals of Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders and others.
We will educate, not indoctrinate our kids, and put students on a path to success.
Citing a labor shortage, Arkansas has moved to ease the work rules for those under 16. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks, Catherine. Last year, when we were celebrating Women's History Month here in the United States, we still had reproductive rights for women. Just a few months later, that fundamental human right was stripped away by the U.S. Supreme Court when it overturned Roe v. Wade. For decades, there's been this dominant narrative that we're on a trajectory of, you know, self-improvement to become that more perfect union rooted in race and gender equality. Yet the reality is that more than half a century after the passage of the U.S. Equal Pay Act, women are still making anywhere between 70-some-odd cents to 82 cents an hour compared to the full dollar earned by their male coworkers. For women of color, the disparity is even more stark. With us now is Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude, which is heard on Pacifica stations around the country and originates on WNHN-FM in Concord, New Hampshire. For decades, Arnie has been a progressive trailblazer in one of the nation's most conservative states. She was elected to the New Hampshire House of Representatives, where she served for several years. In 1992, she became the first woman candidate nominated by a major party to run for governor in that state. 4 years later, she ran for Congress. Trained as a lawyer, she was a fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics, and for multiple presidential election cycles, she has been sought after by the media as the essential in-state source to decode New Hampshire politics. Good morning, Arnie.
Good morning. I was listening to your news and listening to your introduction, and I just want to say something as I was listening to the news today, that they mentioned the idea of repealing the death penalty at the federal level. So let me just remind people, just because you assume that you have like a Democratic governor, that maybe when a repeal comes to her desk, she would vote for it or she would sign it, well, it turns out that our first female Democratic governor, Jean Shaheen, was provided with a repeal of the death penalty while she was governor by a Republican legislature, Bob, and she vetoed it. So sometimes it's also about asking the right questions and making sure that the Democrats that we elect actually believe in the values that we have.
Wow.
I just couldn't help it. I was listening to the news.
I know.
It just triggered that. It just triggered
it. Yeah,
no,
absolutely. You have what we like is positive progressive insights that I just, you know, you do know. This is an example of what you do. I guess we came across the reality that you were the first guest on Democracy Now! One
yes.
time we were
yes so yes, I was her first guest on Amy Goodman's show. It's just so amazing to me. But as all these things that you've been talking about abortion, about the news, about the death penalty, in so many ways it defines my life, everyone. It defines my life. It defines why I entered politics. And the question about abortion will actually lead into, I think, what you want me to do, which is to read my response in The Nation magazine. And you mentioned abortion. So let me just remind everyone, we have a 2024 election coming up for president, probably the most important election in our history. Everyone says that every 4 years. Trust me, this is the time. And when I think of abortion and I think about the fact that the Democrats are rallying around Joe Biden, we are probably not going to be given a choice. I want everyone to know this piece of information. In the first 2 years of Joe Biden's presidency, he never mentioned the word abortion once.
Wow. So anyway, I want to set this up because it is short, the essay in The Nation, but it's part of a compendium of a lot of insightful observations. We are kind of manufacturing consent here, as you've been hearing. If you follow this program, we do have the kind of notion that Biden should just, you know, get the nomination by acclamation. The title to your piece, and I'll set it up for you to read it, is The Urgency of the Moment. Go ahead, take it away.
Okay, here you go, everyone. These four words will define our country's 2024 campaign for president. We face a fundamental threat from the well-funded and anti-democratic fascist wing of the Republican Party that has made its purpose abundantly clear: to serve the rich and the powerful and remove any real or perceived government obstacle to doing so. Joe Biden may indeed understand this threat, but does anyone really see him ginning up Democratic resistance to the GOP with the urgency the moment demands? It is more than a question of his age. It is about this moment when white Christian nationalists and the radical right that control the public coffers of nearly two dozen states are moving forward at lightning speed to advance the implementation of their authoritarian schemes. This moment when scads of billionaire cash are ready to fund this assault. This moment when the reactionary conservative Supreme Court is poised to further impose its retrograde interpretation of the Constitution. The GOP has set the table. Democrats' job is fourfold. We must expand the size of that table and lay out a menu that nourishes the insecure, ensures that America's economic success is reflected in the pockets of all workers, not just CEOs and shareholder portfolios, and support all families. We do that with a leader who energizes voters across multiple generations to seize the urgency presented by the consequential choices we face in 2024. Biden's presidency is most assuredly one of great accomplishment, but this moment demands a leader who is ready to shatter our complacency and slam back against a terrifying future. Joe Biden does not fit that description. That's it, Bob.
So is it enough, I guess, for Democrats to say they should be elected because they're not Donald Trump?
Well, no. I mean, but isn't it ironic that both parties are hoping that these two old men run against each other again?
They Stuck Nation!
Another choice. That's it.
That's my drinking song. I'm having another sip of water.
It must be a replay. And if it's not a replay, everything is screwed up. Everything is screwed up. And if the Republicans produce something other than Donald Trump, then where does Joe Biden stand when he stands on the stage with that younger, more articulate, more aggressive, frankly? I mean, we know how Donald Trump plays the game. You know, my hope is that he's, you know, doing the perp walk and wearing an orange jumpsuit. That may not come to pass. But the problem is Joe Biden's whole agenda is assuming that Trump runs again. If it's not Trump, then not only is there a sense of dissatisfaction with a lot of Democrats already about the idea that he might be our nominee in 2024, but then the question is, given the consequences of 2024, will he be able to speak with the kind of voice we need to not only bring out voters, but to expand that base and make sure the Republicans get a message that they can hear for the next 30 years to come?
So I guess the logical question is, it begs the question, the setup is, who do you have in mind? We know that the Biden operation, the political operation, has kind of created this A-team that includes Governor Murphy, allegedly Governor Whitmer, the Mayor Adams here in New York City, to kind of block and tackle in this cycle of the primary. Are there a constellation of names?
Well, you know, I mean, do I know? I don't. But let me, I said this to you a couple of weeks ago. I have this bizarre concept coming forward. And what it is where am I looking around the country to see the kind of leadership that I want to see when Democrats have the trifecta, when Democrats have the opportunity with a House, a Senate, and the governor's office to actually push an agenda. And you know exactly where I'm going. I'm going to Michigan. And what right. Gretchen Whitmer is doing in Michigan is mind-blowing, everyone. They ran on a promise, and they are delivering it in weeks. In weeks. They're using their power, they're using it effectively, and they're using it to support the people of that state. They've repealed right to work. I mean, it's right. just amazing. That is remarkable. When you look at what they're doing on issues of abortion, when you're looking at what they're doing on a whole conga line of issues that, you know, people say, oh, those are too progressive. No, they're not. They're what people want and need. They don't have a label. They want to be able to earn a living. They want to be able to go to a doctor when they're sick. They want to be able to organize a union. They want to be able to do all these things. Those don't have labels, everyone. You know what they have? They have the word a future and life. You know, in fact, what I call them is, I call them the radical middle. That's what
right.
they are.
So let's,
when
I want to put out,
what
I want,
they, are, they don't define them. Sorry.
I want to get our shareholders in, our listeners, 212-209-2877. You have another candidate. You like the current president that's in there. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. So I wanted to, you know, the kind of the drumbeat that's been going on in the corporate news media that frames the political landscape is that Democrats who want to win need to tack to the center to avoid the progressive policy stance. We've got a mayor in New York City. That's kind of like his Bible. Yet in midterm states, like you saw, like Michigan and Pennsylvania, where Democrats got out their progressive base, they overwhelmingly prevailed and swept, you know, in Michigan particularly, the state legislature, and were able to do the things that you describe in short order. By contrast, in dependable blue Democratic states like New York, New Jersey, and California, turnout was disappointingly low.
Yes, yes.
And we lost the House of Representatives. We had some of our members try to do a tough on crime pivot towards the end because they believe the echo chamber of the New York Post. Could it be that in those states, Democrats failed to project the kind of urgency you described in your Nation essay?
You nailed it. You nailed it. First of all, they're tacking to the middle. Where the Republicans have gone to such an extreme, the middle isn't the middle anymore. It isn't even close to the middle. It is so far to the right. They're giving up so much of what the base wants, what America wants. And so they think that they're playing this game in the center. What does Jim Hightower say? There's nothing in the middle of the road except for dead armadillos and double yellow lines. Well, you know what? The middle of the road now is bigger than a dead armadillo. That's the problem, because how far it has gone to the right. What we need to do is hear what people are asking for. You've heard me say this before. Americans think of themselves as being philosophically conservative, but operationally liberal. And given what's happening in this country, they are demanding the operation over and over again. And what the Democrats need to remind people is, if you are operationally liberal and you need to go to a doctor when you're sick and you need to have FEMA respond to you when there's a hurricane or when there's a tornado, if you need to have your infrastructure repaired, if you need to deal with the climate crisis that's basically eroding your oceanfront, if you need an education for your kid that won't wallow them in debt, then guess what? Operationally liberal means there's only one thing to do, and that is vote for a party that will actually deliver it. You can be as philosophical as you want, but you can't live in that philosophy. You can only live in a world that the Democrats can help to create.
And so I guess looking back at the very mixed record when it comes to labor, I mean, President Biden has packaged himself as the most pro-union president. And yet we see things like the $7.25 minimum wage is still stuck where it's been since 2009. We saw that cruelly they raised the expanded child tax credit for like several months and then poured away, even though it reduced childhood poverty by 40%. We see that the president, the Democratic president and the Democratic Congress actually forced rail workers to take a deal they voted down that didn't include sick days. I mean, I'm just concerned here that you're right that we're not grounded in this, in the actual struggle. What, 2 million women sidelined from the workforce because we don't have universal child care? We lost 16,000 child care centers through the pandemic. I mean, this is what you're, this is actually, when you, when I hear you talk, it's about an expansion of the economy.
Yeah, of course it is. And think about this, Bob. I mean, the thing is, when he ran for president, Joe Biden talked about raising the minimum wage. We haven't heard him say that since. And you know the story of the minimum wage. Whenever they put the minimum wage on the ballot in a referendum, whether it is a red state or a blue state, guess what? It passes.
So, by the way, we've got a full board, and we've got to try to get as many folks on. You're popular all over. You know that. Caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind, and what's your name?
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have had a I have had a question for Arnie since before Roe versus Wade got overturned. Thank you so much, WBAI, and Arnie for being on. On your show, right before, Arnie, Roe versus Wade was overturned, you had, said about a paragraph, and I tried to scour the internet to find it, and I couldn't. And I was wondering if you could either direct me as to where to go or if you could say it again right here, right now, because it was so powerful. And you listed things that women want or do or are expected of. And you were like, if a woman wants to be a good mother, shame. If a woman wants to stay home in order to do that, shame. And like, do you remember that? And
I will try to find it, but think about this. This is not about abortion, everyone. It is about how we define who we are, whether we have a family, whether we don't have a family, whether we go to work, whether we stay home, whether we have a future, whether we can protect our own health. And if our health isn't protected, our family's health isn't protected. Please realize this, everyone. I will try to find that checklist and get that to Bob. But there are so many things that are connected to this issue. And I think if we were able to articulate that, and frankly, if we had a president who could articulate that, imagine that caller, then all of a sudden everybody would realize this is not about abortion. This truly is about the future of who we are. If you want an expanded workforce, then you need to make sure you overturn Dobbs. If you
it's
want
the ultimate
sure
labor right
families, labor, all these things, and yet we haven't heard that kind of voice coming out of the office. And we need that, because that not only reinforces who we are, but then it isn't what DeSantis wants to do, which is to suggest that abortion is a woke issue. It is not a woke issue. It is a life and future issue.
So we have another caller. Caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind, and what's your name?
Hey, it's Russ from White Plains. It's a privilege to talk to Ms. Arneson. And I'd like to know, would she support the targeting of Trump by D.A. Bragg if Bragg indicted Michael Bloomberg for signing NDAs during his election? And this is another sort of an inauthentic women's issue. Does she support drag shows in public libraries in front of children just because they want to read to children? And the, one last thing is, Trump has said the court decision went too far and needs to be addressed. Do you acknowledge that? Bye.
Yes, that is Russ. Yes, we're all familiar with Russ. He's a personality. Go ahead, Arnie.
Well, first of all, Bragg is doing what we, which at this point we don't even know. Do you realize this? Do you see what Trump has done? Trump has already given us an answer that hasn't been produced yet. This is the genius of Donald Trump. Before it even happens, he tells you. He tells you how to think about it. He tells you how to do the analysis. And, of course, what does Trump do? He plays the victim. Really? Ask realtors in New York about the victim Trump. Ask people who've never gotten paid by Trump about the victim Trump. Ask people who went to Trump University about the victim Trump. This man is such a damn manipulator. Brag, go after him. Go after him. I don't care. You get to pick and choose. It's called prosecutorial discretion. And frankly, from my perspective, it's not just about Stormy Daniels. Frankly, what Bragg should be doing is looking back 30 years and checking off every box for everything that Donald Trump did illegally, because he should have been long back into prison or should never been able to run for president just for the criminal and damage he did to the city of New York.
Well, and I would say that I've written extensively about what happened in Atlantic City, and both political parties facilitated his ongoing criminal enterprise. And as long as he cut in the politicians of both parties, nobody had a problem. And so he took his training wheels off in Atlantic City, and he ran roughshod as a real estate person. I mean, what he did, it's all court records. I guess also what I did notice is, again, we're also seeing the issue of the trans issue being used, and this fixation that really does have this fascist underlining of creating an other. And I do think that I've noticed that is another thing. Like, instead of talking about a mass death event that killed over 1 million Americans, that where we know the link between the lack of health care, there's a direct link between that and the huge numbers. We're 4% of the world's population, and many times that the percentage of deaths in the world from COVID. We're not talking about any of that. We fixate on TikTok and trans issues. But, I mean, it really does seem to be like what Trump did.
But Bob, let me take you back to Dobbs. I mean, you were talking about health care and what happened with the mass death event. And we know that there were certain areas where there were historically little access to health care, and that's where we saw the massive numbers of people who ultimately were not able to survive COVID. There is something called match day, everyone. And when match day happens, when you finish your a medical degree and then you decide where you're going to go to pursue your residency. Well, guess what? Because of the Dobbs decision, because so many conservative states are making it very difficult to be a doctor and to do no harm, it turns out that so many doctors, not just OBGYNs, are looking at states and saying, I don't want to do my residency here. I don't want to practice here. What does that mean? That if it was bad before, like in the state of Texas, it's the highest number of uninsured in the country, it is going to be almost impossible for them to attract doctors. We're going to create these healthcare deserts. So what we knew was already a challenge from the perspective of healthcare and healthcare inequality, well, it's going to get worse, and Dobbs is part of that pivot point.
We have one more caller. Caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind, and what's your name?
Hi, I'm calling from the Bronx. My name is Carol. I think at this point it's really absurd to even push us, the working class in the United States, to support the Democratic Party. I mean, we've been betrayed consistently. Obama had all the houses on his side and didn't deliver. The Democratic Party is a party of the bosses as much as the Republican Party. And to have the expectations, even Bernie Sanders, I mean, he is a prime example of why, you know, how phony the Democratic Party was. He could have run. He could have won. The Democratic Party didn't want him because he was too radical. And he stepped aside. And all the things that you said about the Democratic Party and in terms of crushing the strike and drilling for oil and everything has shown that the Democratic Party is a party of the bosses as much as the Republican Party. And so workers need a new party, one that's going to speak for us. The bosses have two parties. We don't have any, and it's.
That's such an important point. I want to get Arnie to respond to. Thanks for calling, and please call again. So, Arnie, what's your response?
I hear you. When I lost my race for governor, it wasn't because of Republicans, everyone. It was because of Democrats. They were afraid of my progressive message. And I remember people saying to me, why don't you just leave the damn party, Arnie? Why don't you leave? So let me say to the caller, here's our job. Let's take it over. Let's take it over. That's our job. I don't want to waste my time recreating something. There are people like you and me still with a D next to our name, even as disgusted as we are, because that's what the D stands for. It doesn't stand for Democrat. It stands for disgusted. But here's what we do. We take this group of disgusted Democrats, and we say, you know what? It's time that you don't play lip service to being pro-union. It's time you deliver on being pro-union. It's the time that you deliver on health care. You talk about health care. The Affordable Care Act doesn't even come close to what we need to do about health care. You want to do something about daycare? They give me $10 a day daycare like they're doing in Canada, everyone. In
right,
Canada,
D for delivery.
Universal health care. So the D is for delivery. It's for disgusted, and it's for delivering, and we need to deliver and take it over.
So how can people follow what you're doing and get in touch with you, and also loop into where Attitude is aired?
Well, we're a tiny little community radio station, WNHNFM.org, WNHNFM.org. My show streams every day at 12, every day at 7 o'clock at night. Please listen. We have podcasts available all over the place. Get our podcast. We are picked up by Pacifica stations all over the country. If you know a Pacifica station, a community station in your area, tell them, grab the Attitude, put us on. I do this every day, everyone. I've been doing it for over a decade. I do it for nothing. I used to be the highest paid talk show host probably in my state. I lost my job because I was doing commercial radio. I was too liberal. But I didn't want to walk away because I know the power of the airwaves. I know the power of the truth. And if I get that truth out, whether it's on a small station or a big station, I will continue to do it.
Thanks so much, Arnie.
You're welcome.
Take care. That's a very dynamic Arnie Arneson, former candidate for the gubernatorial office in New Hampshire and a real progressive trailblazer. We'll be right back.
Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there. Beyond the sky, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York with a moment in women's history.
If we do form a union, we are going to have a political force.
Since the 1950s, Dolores Huerta has been a grassroots organizer in the struggle for equality and civil rights.
People that aren't aware of labor relations don't realize why unions are important.
In the 60s, she co-founded the United Farm Workers and was the chair of contract negotiations.
You know, we did have a chance to sign a contract with the growers. Some of our liberal friends say, well, why didn't you sign that contract? It's a foot in the door is more important. Well, the reason that we didn't sign the contract is because the growers refused to put any protective language on the issue of poisons.
By the 70s, the Farm Workers Union led the charge against environmental racism and pollution with the campaign to ban the use of the pesticide DDT.
See, farm workers sort of took poisoning as a working condition, you know, the same way that they took a lack of a toilet or the lack of hand washing facilities or, you know, the bad treatment that you get. This was just an occupational, you might say, an ordinary thing.
At the time, a sampling showed 80% of farm workers, mostly grape pickers, as well as a large proportion of their children, were affected by DDT. They also found consumers were being affected by poison on the grapes that they were eating.
I think that the whole issue of pesticides that the union has taken on is an important one, because here we're taking on a basic issue that's not important. It's important not only to the farm worker, but to the consumer and also to the environment. And this is, I think, the union, we're certainly trying to make our union to be, to have a conscience, a social conscience that is larger than just the question of bread and butter.
Dolores Huerta later became a leader of the Feminist Majority's Feminization of Power campaign to inspire women, particularly Latina women, to run for public offices to reflect the diversity of the nation. She originated the Si Se Pueda attitude, a personal and organizational spirit that promotes confidence, courage, hard work, and the belief that we can do the impossible, way before Barack Obama campaigned with the phrase, "Yes, we can." You can hear more from Dolores Huerta and other trailblazers by becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member. For $15 or more a month, you'll receive our fabulous, extensive women's history collection and our tote bag. Please go to women.wbai.org, women.wbai.org, to become a WBAI buddy in the name of your favorite program or in the name of all WBAI programs. Or please call 212-209-2950. Do it now. Call 212-209-2950 and say, "Yes, I want to become a WBAI buddy this Women's History Day."
As we go marching, marching, we're standing proud and tall. The rising of the women means the rising of us all. No more the drudge and idler, and a toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses. Our starve as well as bodies, give us bread, but give us roses. Bread and roses, bread and roses.
Please, why don't you call the WBI donation line, 212-209-2950. That's the donor line. That's 212-209-2950. To sign up to become a sustaining WBI buddy to support this program and the others you've come to rely on for a progressive perspective you just won't hear anywhere else on the radio. With your commitment to help sustain WBAI, you'll get this unique Women's History audio collection with 79 hours of restored audio featuring the voices of Margaret Mead, Alice Walker, Helen Caldicott, along with readings from Anais Nin, Anne Sexton, Maya Angelou, Molly Ivins, Rachel Carson, Coretta Scott King, Rosa Parks, Fannie Lou Hamer, and so many more. Please call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950 or go online to WBI.org to make a secure e-pledge. Last week, I got to cover the annual commemoration in Lower Manhattan of the Triangle Garment Fire on March 25th, 1911, that claimed the lives of 146 mostly young immigrant female garment workers. This was the first in-person gathering since the pandemic emergency was declared 3 years ago. I was heartened to see that the event drew a larger, younger, and more energized crowd than in previous years. The catastrophic fire and the subsequent investigation, which revealed an exit had been locked, brought global attention to sweatshop conditions in New York City's garment industry. Ironically, 16 months earlier, 20,000 mostly female garment workers had made labor history when they went out on strike for 4 months and emerged with recognition of their union, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, as well as a 20% raise. Triangle factory owners Max Blanc and Isaac Harris were anti-union holdouts, so it had been a deal widely accepted by the other garment manufacturers. Blanc and Harris were tried twice for manslaughter, but were acquitted. Subsequent civil lawsuits on behalf of the surviving families paid out roughly $75 per victim, several of whom were only 14 years old at the time of their death. The annual ceremony is produced by the New York City Labor Council. Central Labor Council to remember the Triangle Coalition as well as the Workers' Circle. This year, a substantial portion of the crowd wore buttons in support of NYU's Contract Faculty United UAW, who are looking for recognition from NYU, which now owns the Ash Building, the very same building that housed the Triangle Fire. Hannah Gurman, a clinical associate professor at NYU, gave a powerful speech updating the crowd on the status of their campaign. Hannah joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So if you could tell us a bit about you and your own career path so listeners can better get acquainted with the years of study it takes to get to teach at a place like NYU.
Sure, I'm happy to. Well, like everyone who teaches at NYU, I have a PhD in the humanities and social sciences that usually takes somewhere between 6 and 10 years. I've published several books in my area of expertise, which is true of most people who teach in humanities and social sciences at any university. And we are also expected to be excellent teachers and often to have administrative roles as well. So where you end up in academia comes a lot down to luck. There are so many highly qualified people, all of whom have done your track positions available to teach in higher education today.
So what is your field of expertise?
Mostly I write about U.S. foreign relations, the history of U.S. national security and the culture of U.S. national security. I've published a book on dissenters in the staple history of U.S. counterinsurgency and a critical history of U.S. national secrecy and whistleblowing.
Wow, that's some hot topics. In your remarks at the memorial service, which were really moving, you explained the different kinds of relationships that lay people on the outside may not understand academics can have with the university. Let's go over that. I think folks know about tenured faculty, even adjuncts, but contract faculty, how does that work?
Right. So most people don't know what contract faculty are, but we make up 50% of the full-time faculty at NYU. So it's a really important category for people to understand. We have full-time jobs at NYU, so we're not adjuncts. We don't get paid per class. We have an annual salary, and in many parts of the university, we're also part of the governing body of the faculty. But periodically, and the provost of the university, that can be anywhere between 1, 3, or 5 years. So wow. You're constantly reapplying for this job. And really what it comes down to is that we serve at the pleasure of the dean and the provost. And so we rely on the individual goodwill of those people. And that makes our job fundamentally insecure, which is different than tenured faculty exists between us and the tenured faculty at NYU.
Well, and also thinking about the issues that you're exploring as an academic, that's a tough road. You are at the center of some of the most controversial public questions that we have. Where are you guys in the recognition process?
So it's been a while coming. We've been organizing for several years, but things have really taken on momentum in the last semester and even in the last month. 1 month ago, we delivered a petition to NYU's president, Andy Hamilton, that had the signatures of over half of the members of our bargaining unit in support of forming a union. And we asked him to get back to us in a week. It's been longer than a week. It's been a month, but we are finally beginning some conversations, and we're not there yet. The university has not yet agreed to a neutral, fair, and expeditious process that would include all the members of our union, but we are hopeful that we will get there.
Well, callers, if you have an observation, if you yourself are an academic, I know that Rutgers is heating up right now. Things are very intense over there. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. I guess, what are the points that you try to get across? Give me your 60-second elevator pitch to someone that you're trying to get to sign up. I mean, there are some real risks to your career for standing up, I'd imagine. What are some of the key issues that resonate with your colleagues?
Yeah, well, it's always a risk when you step out, but I think people understand that we already exist with risk, that our jobs are fundamentally precarious because we have these contracts that need to be renewed. So the basic issue of job security really resonates with people wanting to have something that goes beyond the individual generosity of people who are your bosses, but to have an institution that is at your back is really, really crucial, and that resonates with people. But there are also more bread and butter questions out there. We are all struggling with inflation, and salaries in higher education are not keeping up with inflation. So people are worried about being able to afford the cost of living in New York. It's hard no matter what, but especially right now with the high inflation. Housing, anybody who lives in New York City knows how expensive housing is. Tenure-track faculty at NYU have access to subsidized housing, but most contract faculty do not. So we struggle to find places to live, and people often have to have really long commutes. So that raises issues for especially for people with children and childcare and work-life balance. And also clinical faculty are often burdened with more administrative duties than other faculty around the university. So all of these issues are really resonating with our union members. And one of the challenges is finding out, you know, NYU is such a big place. It's really an empire. And so each school around NYU has different people with, you know, they're going to have some different issues in each of the schools. And really one of the reasons that we need a union is so that we can find out what's going on across these different areas of the NYU empire and come together and share our experiences. So, again, it's a union that can do that for us.
Yeah, it's like the university that ate Lower Manhattan. I want to ask you about this question. Is it possible, is there precedent for you to, after you get a couple of multi-year contracts, to move into a tenure track? How does that connection work?
Well, NYU makes it really hard to do that. They created these lines in order to have more flexible work, you know, to have a more flexible workers. And so,
yes, we call it the precariat. I think that's something James Parrott, the first time The Economist referred to the precariat.
The precariat, right. And they prefer the word flexible because that sounds better, right? So, no, not really. It comes down to really creating these parallel tracks and saying that this is, you were hired on this track and this is the track. If you were to want a tenure job, you would need to apply for another job around the country and get that job. And then maybe you could come back and say, you know, we're going to threaten to leave you. But it really, they make it a point of saying that this is its own track. It's the same thing for adjunct faculty who also teach so many courses around NYU. And there's really no difference in terms of the quality of their work. It's just that they were hired in a job that exists only at that level. And it's very, unfortunately, comes down to luck and randomness and the fact that the university keeps these tenure track jobs deliberately scarce. Has nothing to do with how many students are in college and how many people need to be taught. It really is about structuring the labor system so that very few people have access to those tenured jobs.
So we've got a full board of callers. Callers, where are you calling from? What's on your mind and what's your name?
Good morning. Thomasina from Bergen County. How's everybody?
Yay!
Yay! So, okay. I am more disturbed than ever. Never even knew this contract thing, even existed. I am so angry at so many different people. Number one, why do the professors get away with this? Okay, the professors are the problem. They think they're so high and mighty that they don't want other people to have access to tenure. And it's quite disgusting, and I am so fed up with the professors in every school. I mean, this is just a way for them to keep their so-called prestige and all that crap. So I want to hear about why aren't the professors letting you in their union, because they're in a union, and NYU is filthy rich. I don't know why you guys just don't organize and walk the hell out and just go get different jobs if you you can't change this situation. Why do you put up with this? This is what I don't understand. You're so educated. Why do you put up with this? And this is the same problem we have at the high school and other public school levels. The teachers are so educated, but yet they have no consciousness as workers. And this is the biggest problem in teaching, all the way up to the professor level. Those professors don't see themselves as workers. They think they're high and mighty. It's a big problem. And I am disgusted because I am an alumni of NYU, and I know how much money they have. And I'm on the parent page, and let me tell you something. They have classes that have 700 kids are suffering, and I'm sorry. It just goes on and on and on, Bob.
So, of course, Thomasina, thank you for calling. And, of course, you're an educator, and you're quite experienced as a union organizer. So there's a lot to unpack there. I was going to ask you about there's been success. Tenure track folks have had success organizing. But can you speak to Thomasina's point about this? Do the professors who have a full-time position, what's that, your relationship with them?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a really interesting area. I would just, one point is that NYU faculty are not legally permitted to organize a union, but the vast majority of my tenure track colleagues are very supportive of our efforts to form a union. And I would say here, yes, NYU is filthy rich, but I would not target the tenured faculty who are mostly supportive. It's really the administration that has the power to make these changes. So they're the ones that could give everybody tenure if they wanted to.
Right. Like, exactly right. We have another call. We have another caller on the line. We're coming up against the clock. Caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind? What's your name?
Hi, Doug from Staten Island, retired educator. Very briefly, just counterposed to the last thing that you just said, if the tenured and the professors were more proactive, I think you guys would have a lot more to lean on if they all were threatening. But they dare not. They enjoy their cushy position. So I somewhat agree with the last caller. Here's a question. It has a couple of different parts to it. Number one, what are the provisions of New York State law that allow you the latitude to go on with the process of possibly uniting together and forming a strike? That's number one. Number two, in the contract people, what is your average lifespan in these things here? What percentage of your people are on their first or second contract things, and how much
Great
do
question.
They have to or how much do they have to lose? Is that what's holding you back? Number three, if you guys had decided to actually form a strike, what would happen on that occasion? Would you be let go, or do you have some sort of latitude in that area?
Thank you so much, caller. Hannah?
Thanks for those questions. So first, on the legal question, there's nothing in New York State law that is preventing us from forming a union. That is why the university is not telling us that we can't form a union. That's why so far they've been mostly delaying and stalling and talking with their lawyers about what they're going to do with us. In terms of the contract numbers, I don't have the statistics. Again, what I said before, NYU is a gargantuan school. This includes places like the College of Arts and Science, the College of Nursing, where I work, the Gallatin School of Individualized Study. So we do have different situations across those different schools. In my school, the Gallatin School of Individualized Study, you can get promoted, and so you go from three-year contracts to five-year contracts, and historically, the professors there are renewed, but there are other areas around the school where the jobs are much more precarious. So again, the union effort is gathering that information, but I don't have it at my fingertips.
Well, thank you very much for that. Was a lot of detail. If you could tell us how they can get in contact with you, how can we support what you guys are doing? It's so important.
Absolutely. So continue doing what you're doing to follow these issues of labor and higher education. It's not only us, but there are budget battles at CUNY and SUNY and looming strike at Rutgers and elsewhere across the landscape of higher education. So to pay attention. And if you can follow our campaign as we continue to put pressure on NYU this spring, we're at CFU UAW, and we regularly post on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. So you can keep abreast of everything we're doing. And if we have events, come out and support us. That would be amazing.
Thank you so much, Hannah Gurman.
Thank you.
That's Hannah Gurman working with Faculty United, UAW. Frenchie Davis is in this space tomorrow. Democracy Now! Is up next. And remember, you get the world you fight for.
Law and Disorder.
Hi, I'm Hydeep Goshen.
And I'm Michael Smith. We're here to announce the new time for our program Law and Disorder. It'll now be every Monday at 11 a.m.
Law and Disorder exposes rampant injustices emanating from the U.S. courtrooms, boardrooms, police precincts, and more.
We interview leading experts in the law, as well as authors, activists, and academicians who are working to bring about lasting and positive social change.
We launched the show 18 years ago with the great great constitutional human rights litigator, Michael Ratner. We've been reinforced by three nationally recognized attorney co-hosts.
Jim Lafferty in Los Angeles, Marjorie Cohn in San Diego, and Julie Hurwitz in Detroit.
Each week, we bring you a one-hour show interviewing legal and political leaders across the country.
Our new time will be Monday morning at 11 a.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City.
WBAI New York. We're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much for tuning in. Coming up next will be Democracy Now! Any Monday with David Roth.